Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Well, there's nothing like having some fun about talking about radio on radio. So I welcome to the show Cynthia Myers, who's an associate professor of communication at the College of Mount St. Vincent's in New York City. Good morning, Cynthia.
Hi, good morning.
How are you today?
Pretty good, thanks.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward. As our listeners heard earlier, I got stuck on airplanes all day yesterday, and I was so happy to have a companion, meaning your new book, a word from our sponsor, AdMen Advertising and the Golden Age of Radio. So let me briefly introduce Cynthia. She received her PhD in radio, television, film from the University of Texas at Austin. Her new book, as I mentioned, is a word from our sponsor. It both enriches and corrects, in many regards, our understanding not only of broadcasting history, but also the advertising history, business history, and really the American cultural history from the 1920s to around the 1940s. Her work really repositions the advertising industry from the margins into what I believe as well is the center of the most significant popular culture form of the 20th century. And then that, as we often say, history will repeat itself, could help us also better understand the changes that are affecting media industries in a really profound way, particularly the digital internet world here in the 21st century. So again, Cynthia, congratulations on your work. Nothing like, I'm sure, having it in front of you after your years of research, right?
Yes, it's been very exciting to finally have it out in the world.
You know, I'm sure someone would say a PhD in radio, television, and film. How fun would that be? Tell me, how did you get an interest in this field?
When I was very young, I was in the fine arts for a while. And then I realized I needed to make a living, and I started looking at other things, and I got very interested in media and American culture as expressed through the mass media. So I ended up going to graduate school and studying the history of American media. And I looked at advertising because I thought that was an interesting place to understand American culture and how it interacts with commercialism. And the more I looked into it, that's when I discovered that actually the advertising industry had basically created broadcasting by building it as a commercial medium in the 20s and 30s, and then by directly producing a lot of the popular entertainment of that era. And this was something that I felt that more people should be aware of, because advertising has not only underwritten most of our media culture of the 20th century and into the 21st. But today, we're going back to a lot of the strategies that advertisers and ad industry were using in the 30s and 40s as in digital media, when advertisers are really trying hard to reach audiences who now have lots of different choices.
Exactly.
And lots of ways,
yep,
of avoiding advertising. And so they're going back to things like integrating the ads and sponsoring the entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
All sorts of things like that are going on again.
And so all we're seeing is that circle of change coming back, if I could take that metaphor from the title of our show here. Well, I think your very first comment here, really for me when I read your book, was caught me by surprise. Not being mindful or cognizant of how much the advertising industry itself really created the broadcasting world, as opposed to advertising, I don't know, lack of a better word, exploiting broadcasting to make money on their shoulders. They were in and of a part of it in the genesis, particularly of early radio programs. I know in your book you also bring forward some really important understandings for the reader about the difference between hard sell and soft sell, and how different organizations took a different approach right from the get-go of their leaders. But perhaps a good place where we can start just to have some fun with this is, why don't we cue up one of the segments, Cynthia, that you sent us. And the first one that we'll play actually has to do with Oxidol. So you want to give us
right.
a preface before we play this?
Sure. The agency that produced this program, it was a daytime serial designed for housewives, and they believed in the hard sell approach. And in hard sell, they believed in advertising as being very informational and about the product. And they were very repetitive because they were afraid that the listeners weren't really paying attention because they were busy washing the dishes or sweeping the floor. And so this kind of advertising was very long-winded. And to us today, it sounds kind of obnoxious. And in fact, it was criticized for being obnoxious at the time. But the people who were writing it this way on purpose. So you can play some of it or all of it, depending on how much you can stand.
Right, there we go. Let's play it in. Don't you love it? I love this music.
And here's Occidental known Ma Perkins again, the true life story of a woman whose life is the same, whose surroundings are the same, whose problems are the same as those of thousands of other women in the world today. A woman who spent all her life taking care of her home, washing and cooking and cleaning and raising her family. And now her husband's death hits her head foremost into being the head of the family as well as the mother. And we'll hear her true life story every day at the same time except Saturday and Sunday. Before we hear from our person today, though, I want to tell you about something else for a minute that will be of vital interest to every housewife listening. About a remarkable new laundry soap discovery that actually makes any other kind of laundry soap old-fashioned and out of date. It's the new, improved Oxidol, spelled O-X-Y-D-O-L, Oxidol. It embodies the latest scientific discovery of the world's greatest soap makers, the Procter & Gamble Company. Whatever soap you've been using in the past, whether it's a granulated soap, a soap flake, or a bar soap, you owe it to yourself to try this new, improved Oxidol. For it makes washing easier, gets the washing done faster, and is safer for colors and fabrics than any other laundry soap now or ever known. Here's what Oxidol will do for you under guarantee of the world's greatest soap makers. Oxidol will wash your clothes 25 to 40% faster, whether you use a tub or the latest improved washing machine. It washes clothes 4 to 5 shades whiter by actual scientific tests than any other soap can do, and absolutely without scrubbing or boiling. And remember that even your best cotton prints and your children's baby frocks are safe in mild, thick Oxidol suds because it embodies a new discovery which keeps all the fast-washing and white-washing qualities in the soap and leaves all the harshness out. It's safe for colors, safe for fabrics, and yet...
You're right. I had to turn him off.
Yes, right.
For one who doesn't iron, you know, but the other subtle part, of course, for our listeners is this was all part of this television program show called Ma Perkins. And so the advertising agency, Wright, really was doing the full scripts, the casting, everything for that show about Ma Perkins, and then Oxidol was interspersed within the promotion.
Right, and you notice that they connected it to the show, and the show was about a housewife, you know, struggling with problems, and so then they contextualized the ad as being, you know, helping solve the problems that housewives everywhere face, housewives like Ma Perkins. And you notice that they keep mentioning soap, and they spell out the name because they don't trust the audience to remember the name, and they repeat the name. So this kind of advertising is extremely old-fashioned now. It's no longer in fashion, and that's in part because advertisers today understand that audiences are not stupid, they're sophisticated, they're smart, and that advertisers have to be much more subtle and indirect to get audiences' attention. But at the same time that the hard sell was going on, there were ad agencies practicing the soft sell. And the soft sell advertising agencies like Young Rubicam, they believed in humor and emotional appeals in order to get the audience's attention. And so, for example, Fred Allen, who was a well-known radio comedian, one of the commercials that Young and Rubicam wrote for him, he and the announcer, Harry Von Zell, pretend to forget the name of the program's sponsor,
exactly,
which was Sal Hepatica.
Well, let's play that commercial.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please. Someone once said that the world stands aside to make way for the man who knows where he's going. And so tonight it gives me great pleasure to make way for a man who knows what he's talking about. Harry Von Zell.
Don't ever neglect the cold. At the very first sign of a cold, get after it immediately with the faster help of what's the name?
Fred Allen, remember?
No. The name of the... I'm awfully sorry, that eagle has upset me. I can't remember the name of what it is that helps fight cold faster. It slipped my mind.
Well, it'll come to you. Go ahead, Harry.
Well, yes, of course. Ladies and gentlemen, this famous product acts very quickly. yet it's exceptionally gentle. And since the progress of a cold is very fast, the greater speed of what it is I'm talking about is especially important in fighting your cold. And that's not all. The name will come to me in a minute. It also helps nature counteract the acidity that so often accompanies a cold. And ladies and gentlemen, you can check these facts with your own doctor.
You'd better check the name, too, ladies and gentlemen.
Fred, you know what I'm talking about.
Why, certainly, Harry. You're talking about America's outstanding saline laxative.
That's it, Fred. And the name is...
The name is, so many physicians recommend it.
Yes, yes, and it helps fight colds faster. But what is the name?
Well, here's a pretty to-do. Wait, Harry, there must be somebody around here who knows... If there is, would you please tell us confidentially? That's it. Sal Hepatica. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Boy, the idea of engaging the audience that were there for that live show, right?
Exactly. And I think this commercial is a brilliant example of how instead of repeating the name and banging people over the head with it, they got people to think about the name because Bristol-Myers, which made this laxative, was the sponsor of the show, and everybody knew Sal Hepatica was the product that was sponsoring the show. So everyone listening was thinking the name of the product throughout this entire dialogue. So it was a much more effective way to get people to think about the product. And it was humorous, too. People were laughing. You can hear the audience laughing along at this, you know, silliness. And I think today advertisers use humor. It's one of the top strategies that they use today because, you know, they're trying to disarm people into paying attention to the advertising and trying to give them some pleasure in engaging with it.
Yeah, well said. Cynthia, could you perhaps give us a little bit of a bigger context at how so many of these radio shows that started out back in the 20s and the 30s were indeed sponsored by consumer products, home improvement, and food and beverage, wasn't it?
Sure, yeah. So what happened when radio got started in the 20s, was in other countries like Great Britain, the government sort of used it as a communication service. And so the government taxed radio sets and used that tax money to fund programming on the BBC. But in the United States, the federal government did not want to control content. I mean, there's the First Amendment, there's the news media, and there was a sense that if this is going to be communications media, they should figure out how to commercialize it in some way. But in the 1920s, there was a lot of concern that if they used it for direct advertising, it would alienate listeners. And so they tried to come up with ways of making it into an ad platform without alienating people. And so the first way they started doing that was by offering airtime to advertisers who would provide like music entertainment, and then they would just name the entertainment after their product. So the Ever Ready Hour was sponsored by the Ever Ready Battery Company, and they just provided entertainment, music, and they hoped that people would just be grateful for it, and they'd go out and buy Ever Ready batteries because, gee, Ever Ready, you know, puts on this great music show.
And, oh, by the way, Ever Ready supplied the batteries to run the radios as well, so this was a way to boost radio sales at the same time.
Exactly, exactly. It was a way for them to stimulate more radio battery sales, too. So, but what happened was the Depression came along, and broadcasters felt like they would go out of business if they had to finance the programming themselves. And so they really, and especially like at NBC, they really started promoting radio as an advertising medium. And a number of people in the ad industry didn't want to go into radio because they saw it simply as doing a medicine show. Like patent medicines used to be sold by banjo players in these carts. They'd pull into town, put on a show, and then try to sell patent medicine. So they saw this association with entertainment as being something that might undermine their advertising. But enough advertisers started realizing that if they provided entertainment and then integrated the advertising into the entertainment, they could sell more goods and they could reach wide audiences. And so radio started turning into a more direct advertising medium. But through the 1930s into the 1950s, the advertisers owned the time.
Yeah,
so the broadcasters really had nothing to do with the programs. They would buy, you know, Monday night from 8 to 9 p.m., and then the advertiser and its agency would choose the program, choose the stars, you know, write the scripts, you know, negotiate with the network over the time. So the networks were really just you know, like the telephone company. They were just carrying the content, and they weren't shaping it, choosing it, selecting it at all. The advertisers were. So by the 1950s, there'd been a lot of backlash against that, and a lot of people were arguing that advertisers, you know, shouldn't be controlling the content, that broadcasting should be more like magazines, where you have an editorial staff, and then you have the advertising, and it's separate, and advertisers just buy pages in between the articles. And so it's really in the 1950s that you start to see that shift when television comes along.
And so this was 30 years later, and in fact, those advertising companies, as you explain in your book, they actually had full-up radio programming departments, and one, in fact, that they really were the foundation. I think I read that, is it the Hummert couple?
Yeah.
They actually created almost 50% of the scripts and 50% of the on-air shows came from these two people and the team they had backing them up.
Yes, exactly. And
huge power.
Right. And so one reason that most people aren't aware of any of this, even people who are familiar with a lot of old radio, is that they never had any on-air credit.
Right.
And that was done on purpose. So J. Walter Thompson wrote every line that Bing Crosby said on Kraft Music Hall, but there was never a line saying Carol Carol at J. Walter Thompson, the agency wrote this, because it was believed advertisers didn't let their agencies sign, you know, their ads in magazines because they felt that that would undermine the effectiveness of the advertising strategy, and they saw the entertainment itself as an advertising strategy. And so the fact that the advertising agencies were actually creating these programs and conceptualizing them and producing them and writing them, that was never publicized.
Never published. Interesting. We're speaking with Cynthia Meyer, whose new book is called A Word from Our Sponsor, Ad Men, Advertising, and the Golden Age of Radio. Cynthia, we have one final clip that you provided us from Ivory Soap. Could you give us a background on that?
Sure. So one of the strategies that was very common in this period was cast commercials, where the people, the characters in the program would talk about the product. And this is a way of interweaving the program through the interweaving the product in a way that wouldn't alienate audiences. And today, advertisers are trying similar things again. Target had cast commercials during the sitcoms Modern Family and The Middle, where they had the characters come out and, you know, talk about Target. Another sitcom, Hot in Cleveland, just did a live cast commercial. I think it was just last week. So this strategy is returning, and it's a way of getting people to pay attention to the sales pitch without disturbing them from the actual show. Mm-hmm. And here's a little clip where a character on the show is talking to her maid about what soap to use.
And now, before the overture to the second act of The Gibson Family, let's step backstage and look in on Sally Gibson and Hilda, her maid, who is helping Sally change for the next scene.
Quick, Hilda, hold this dress. I've never been so excited in all my life.
It's really wonderful, isn't it, Miss Sally?
Too wonderful. That scene in the garden.
It made me think of Henry, Miss Sally. Miss Sally, if I had your complexion, do you suppose Henry would...
What, Hilda?
Help me, what's wrong with my face, Miss Sally? Those red blotches just won't go away.
Soap, probably. What kind are you using? Some beauty soap, I suppose.
Yes, Miss Sally. That one that promises radiant beauty, glamorous youth, irresistible loveliness. Oh, Miss Sally, I had hoped Henry would...
Yes, so did I once. And then I learned the truth. Hilda, you can't feed the pores of your skin with beauty oils or mysterious ingredients.
No.
And many highly perfumed, prettily colored soaps contain fatty acids and free alkali that really irritate and harm your skin.
But, Miss Sally...
My doctor recommended Ivory. He says all any soap can do is cleanse. And that to protect the fine texture and pores, a soap should cleanse gently. And that to do that, a soap must be pure. He said Ivory would help to keep my skin smooth and fine.
And Miss Sally, do you think Henry would...
Oh, quick, my gloves, Hilda. Is the bell for the second act?
No, Hilda will never get a Grecian nose by using a beauty soap. But we do hope she gets Henry. And now for the overture to our second act. All right, Don.
And isn't that something? So in some regards, Cynthia, you're saying some things don't change if indeed... Now advertisers with programmers and sponsors are injecting a Target commercial or dialogue, shall we say, in the middle of Modern Family. Bingo. No new ideas.
Right. And part of what I think is happening is when you have a new media technology, and radio was kind of like the internet of the 20s, where people could get access to free content, and there was no way to make them pay, because once you had a radio receiver, you could get the broadcast. And the internet is like that as well. It's very difficult to kind of set toll gates on the internet, so you have to build a business model. And one way to build a business model is to charge advertisers for access to those audiences. But what happened in television and in radio in the 60s and 70s is that the advertising then became separate, and advertisers just bought minutes of time in between the broadcaster's content or programming. And that way the broadcasters could build radio and television, you know, as an effective ad medium overall, because they could create audience flow from program to program, and then the advertisers could select which audience they wanted to buy access to. But today, now that, you know, we're going to digital media and there's less linear media, the problem for advertisers is that they no longer know that they can get access to those audiences just by sliding an advertisement in the middle of the program. And so because, you know, audiences now are more mobile, advertisers are trying to come up with ways to reach audiences without, you know, necessarily being separate from the mm-hmm. content. So we have more and more advertisers who are sponsoring their own programs. AT&T created a teen reality summer program called At Summer Break. It wasn't on television. It was on Tumblr and Twitter and YouTube. And we also have lots and lots of advertisers are integrating their products into all sorts of programs, both scripted and unscripted reality shows. And again, they're trying to do things like celebrity associations, very, you know, powerful and popular strategy, which again, J. Walter Thompson, back in the radio era, they had lots of radio shows with lots of stars who would then talk about why they were using the product. So the power of a celebrity association with a product is another really important strategy that is, again, it's coming back and is more important again, and precisely because we're going through this technological change and advertisers have to reconsider how to use these strategies effectively.
Absolutely. And in fact, of course, your book also lays out the whole shifts that were happening when the epicenter was expanding from just New York City and the home of the broadcasting companies to then the influence of Hollywood and film and the star power there and the intersection points. Before we run out of time, it might be important, too, your book does take us all the way into World War II. So World War I and World War II, the effect of this partnership and the role of advertising and the propaganda campaigns underway to support the war effort.
Yes, and actually I think this is a really interesting thing that happened, which was during the war, the government needed to get propaganda out, which was how to support the war effort, you know, grow a victory garden, recycle your rubber tires, and also factories that had been producing consumer goods could no longer produce them because they were now producing things for the war effort, mm-hmm. you know, like radios and Jeeps. So consumers couldn't buy goods. So the big problem was, well, how do you maintain the media industry that's dependent on advertising? And then how do you get the propaganda out? So the federal government decided to allow advertisers to continue to take tax deductions on their advertising expenses, even though they weren't selling goods anymore. For the most part, they were just selling their war effort. They would put ads in saying, oh, we're supporting the war effort. And the other thing they did was they went to advertisers on radio and they said, well, instead of just, you know, having announcements about recycling or victory gardens, here's the theme, and integrate it any way you want to in the program. So it can be a song, it can be a comedy sketch,
which is just a wonderful way to indeed include that in the
exactly
entertainment side.
Yeah,
well, great,
Cynthia,
thank you so very much. We're running out of time here, but the book, again, is A Word from Our Sponsor by Cynthia Myers. Thank you so much for joining us here on the show.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.